it's about choice. You know, it's about should or should not, in Alaska, parents have the choice to send their children to a private school.
A school voucher program runs into resistance in the legislature. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, January 23rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the captain of the Renda talks about the experience of delivering fuel to Nome.
If you consider this as a normal work, what they do, that's a regular job. Nothing extraordinary.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years.
The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2012 PFD. Also, paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
A bill giving state money to private and religious schools ran into opposition today before the House Education Committee. The bill sets up a mechanism providing state scholarships to private school students. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
The basic requirement the bill sets up for the payment is that the school agrees to meet specific standards and that the student's parents request the money be paid to the school. It's worth as much as the basic student allocation, although it could be limited by the overall size of any special legislative appropriation to pay for it. The state constitution prohibits what the bill would allow, but the plan's sponsor, Wasilla Republican Wes Keller, has introduced a constitutional amendment repealing that provision. That's in a resolution now pending in the House Finance Committee. The bill was heard by the Education Committee four times last year. However, based on some negative feedback then, it's been substantially changed, as Keller explained. He told the committee that all the changes and the questions come down to the basic issue he wants to focus on.
It's about choice. You know, it's about should or should not, in Alaska, parents have the choice to send their children to a private school. It's as simple as that.
The members of the Education Committee had other concerns for Keller. For example, is it discriminatory against any student with special needs? Anchorage Democrat Sharon Cisna said it would seem a private school might choose not to accept a special needs student for whom the school would have to provide special services.
It's not public school, but does that mean the public doesn't have a fair chance?
Keller said that was a valid question, and he asked that it be held for further discussion. Other opposition is more specific about the effects of the law, however. Jeffrey Mittman, the executive director of the Alaska ACLU, said about three-quarters of the private schools in the state are also religious schools, and that puts them under a different federal standard than public schools.
The Supreme Court of the United States ruled just last week that private religious schools are, to a significant extent, exempt from the Americans with Disabilities Act. So it could very well be that through this bill, there could be Alaska state funding of a school legally entitled to discriminate on the basis of disabilities.
Bittman also told the committee that even if voters approve Keller's constitutional amendment, it could entangle the state in religious issues over public funding and public limitations. That was echoed by Steve Evanson of the Northwest Religious Liberty Association. While neither is supporting nor opposing the bill, Evanson warned that the independent religious mission of church schools could become vulnerable to government through regulation.
Such as determining what can and cannot be taught, and during a financial crunch, cause the crippling and shutdown of said schools due to the sweeping withdrawal of such voucher-based financial support.
Committee Chairman Alan Dick originally planned to move the bill from committee, but after 2 hours of debate, decided to hold it until Friday's meeting. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
The state has released a new report on sulfalane contamination in North Pole. Historic spills of the industrial solvent at a local oil refinery contaminated groundwater in a large area, and 285 private wells have tested positive for the chemical. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the latest information from the state confirms earlier safety precautions.
Most property owners whose wells have been contaminated by sulfalane have been set up with alternative drinking water sources. Refinery owner Flint Hills has provided home treatment systems, bulk water storage tanks, and bottled water. Alaska Department of Health sulfalane report author Nim Ha says it supports continuation of a recommendation not to ingest tainted well water.
In terms of using impacted well water for any consumption purposes, you know, drinking or making foods where the water is consumed, like beverages or soups, we do recommend that impacted residents continue to use their alternative water supply.
Ha says sulfalane contaminated water also should not be used to water fruit and vegetable gardens, but the study shows the tainted water is safe for many other non-ingestive uses.
Bathing, washing clothes and dishes, rinsing foods, and making foods where the water is discarded, for example, boiling eggs.
The sulfalane contamination of groundwater was detected during routine tests of monitoring wells in 2009, more than a decade after the suspected source of the pollution, spills at the North Pole refinery, occurred. The discovery led to additional testing of off-site wells, and more low-level contamination turned up. There's concern that some people may have been drinking tainted well water for many years, but Ha says a review of North Pole area disease data from 1997 to 2007 reveals no likely impacts.
We looked at data in the state's cancer registry and birth defects registry, and we did not find an increase in either overall cancer rates or birth defects rates in the North Pole community compared to the rest of the state.
Ha cautions that the North Pole area's small population makes it difficult to come up with statistically significant data. The toxicity findings in the state report are based on a few existing sulfalane studies, and Ha says those investigations are of limited scope.
The main challenge has been that there are no long-term studies in either animals or people that have looked at the health impacts of low-level exposure to sulfalane in drinking water.
Ha says the longest study looked at guinea pigs that ingested sulfalane over a six-month period. She says the animals suffered subtle liver and spleen effects. She says sulfalane is not a known carcinogen, but additional study is needed. The state is waiting to hear back from the National Toxicology Program on a proposed chronic sulfalane exposure study. Meanwhile, Department of Environmental Conservation Project Manager Ann Ferris says the state is working with refinery owner Flint Hills to clean up groundwater around the original point source spills.
The contaminated water is being pumped out of the ground and run through a series of treatments.
Ferris says a plan is in the works to treat the off-refinery 2-mile by 3-mile affected area where private wells have come up positive for sulfalane contamination. She says remediation options are being tested for the larger area.
One option that looks viable and is being tested is air sparging, which consists of injecting oxygen into the subsurface, down into the groundwater, and that accelerates degradation, breakdown of the sulfalane.
Ferris says testing will continue and a final treatability study will be completed by the end of the year. She says full-scale remediation is a year to a year and a half out. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
With its lengthy stretches of coastline, rapid currents, and big waves, Alaska could be capable of producing about 1/5 of the nation's electricity. That's according to two new reports released by the United States Department of Energy that find that the state's waters have enough energy in them to produce more than 850 terawatt hours of electricity every year. That's enough to run over 800 billion space heaters all day, year round. Right now, only about 6% of the nation's electricity comes from hydropower resources. The Department of Energy is aiming to boost water power usage up to 15% by 2030. Mike Reed is the team leader for DOE's water program, and he says the development of ocean energy could be a big part of meeting that objective.
We believe ocean energy is one of the few remaining options that have yet been taken advantage of to pursue clean energy options for the United States. You know, we're aggressively pursuing wind and solar, geothermal, and some other technologies. But ocean energy has largely been untapped and yet represents a terrific opportunity.
According to one assessment, the most productive regions in Alaska are Cook Inlet, the Aleutian Islands, and Bristol Bay. Water program staffer Hoyt Batty says Alaska's coastal and island communities are uniquely positioned to take advantage of ocean energy.
The resource is there, and given the coastal distribution of communities in Alaska, I think it has one of the highest potentials for near-term development of the technologies in the next few years.
However, while Alaska's waters are capable of producing plenty of energy, developing it all wouldn't be cost-effective, especially in sparsely populated regions. The Department of Energy is conducting a technical and economic assessment of what developing ocean energy would entail and how much potential energy could realistically be harnessed. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the young winner of the Cusco 300 celebrates his big win.
I had a great run and, you know, was going really fast, and I didn't even say a word. The dogs were just, you know, doing their thing.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. 8 hours after you quit smoking, your blood oxygen level returns to normal. In 3 months, your lung function improves up to 30%. And 10 years after you quit, your risk of dying from lung cancer is about half that of a smoker. But right now, you're one cigarette closer to cancer. Every cigarette makes you sick, so quit smoking today. Information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
The rats are gone from Rat Island, and the name might follow suit. The Aleut Corporation and the Aleutian Pribilof Island Association recently voted to ditch the now inaccurate moniker and revert to the traditional Unungan name. KUCB's Stephanie Joyce has more.
The story goes that sometime in the 1700s, a Japanese ship wrecked on the island, which lies at the western end of the Aleutian chain. Rats from the ship quickly made their way onto land, where they found a veritable feast of rodent delicacies. Like most of the Aleutian Islands, Hawadak was home to ground-nesting seabirds with no natural defenses against the rats. So it didn't take long for them to overrun the island. Aleutian Maritime National Wildlife Refuge spokesperson Poppy Benson says at that time, the Aleutians were still mostly rat-free.
A lot of the islands that got rats got them in World War II. So back in the 1800s, when the Russians were naming things, and then later the Americans, there probably weren't. That was probably very unique to have rats on an island.
And so was born the name. But back in 2008, the refuge and its partners undertook an ambitious project to eradicate the rats and restore the natural ecosystem. It involved $3 million, two helicopters, and enough poison to target every square yard of the island. The effort appears to have paid off. Researchers returned in 2009 and 2010 and found no evidence of rats. In fact, Benson says they found bird species were reappearing.
They put out song meters, and they found storm petrels calling, leeches storm petrels calling on the island. And no storm petrels were nesting there before. Storm petrels burrow into the ground, and so they would be totally wiped out by rats.
Fish and wildlife archaeologist Debbie Corbett says that's a big change from the first time she was on the island.
We were really struck by how quiet Rat Island was. There were just almost no birds.
Corbett was studying how the loss of birds had impacted the Unungan population that lived on the island at the time of the shipwreck.
Well, they ate birds, obviously, but they also used the bones for tools and the feathers and skins for clothing and decorations and stuff. So with the change in the bird populations, they would have had to either change what they were doing and how, or they would have had to go farther to get the same kinds of materials.
Corbett says in light of the eradication, it's only fitting that the island revert to the name it had before the rats.
And I don't know what Hawadak means, if it ever had any deeper meaning than that island, but it's much more of a celebration name than, you know, rat.
It might be a while, though, before the island is officially called Hawadak. The state has to give their opinion on the renaming this spring and then forward that recommendation to the U.S. Board on Geographic Names. They'll get to make the final decision. In the meantime, Corbett is already dreaming bigger. Hawadak and the islands surrounding it are collectively called the Rat Islands. Corbett says she hopes someday that name can change too. Reporting in on Alaska, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
The tanker Renda and the Coast Guard cutter Healy are 115 miles south-southwest of Nome after beginning their return journey through the ice 2 days ago. Ice conditions have been easier when compared to their initial trip north, but the ships are not yet halfway. They still have more than 300 miles of ice to go.
They're still a long ways from the ice edge, but the ice edge is moving south, so it's moving away from them too.
That's Kathleen Cole, the sea ice program leader with the National Weather Service. She says the ice has continued to expand in the days since the ships first traveled through it. The ice grew by 60 miles during their week-long anchor in Nome and could grow by another 60 to 90 miles over the next 10 days. Guiding the Renda through the ice is an experienced Russian captain who says this kind of fuel delivery mission is no big deal in his home country. KNOM's Matthew Smith has the story.
Kapitan Sergei Stepanovich, Kapitan Tankera Renda.
You're hearing Sergei Stepanovich Kaputov, the captain of the Russian ice-class tanker Renda. He's 29 years old, tall and with a stoic face that threatens to bloom into a smile as he talks. He's worked with Rimsko, Renda's owner and an operator of a small fleet of ships out of Vladivostok, for more than 4 years, navigating icy waters and performing Arctic deliveries in the Russian Far East. In fact, after asking why he's on the Renda, and after a little gentle prodding from our interpreter, he admits that he's one of Rimsko's most seasoned ice navigators.
For
almost 4 years, I'm participating in deliveries in the Arctic.
That interpreter is Mikhail Shestakov, the supply and logistics manager with Vitus Marine, the company that chartered the Renda for fuel delivery. Mikhail has been aboard the Renda since Dutch Harbor and acted as an interpreter for Captain Kaputov along the way. Despite his accomplishments, though, the captain is humble. He was a little reluctant to be interviewed, and he says himself that he's not one for speeches.
I'm not a very good talker. I don't know how to make speeches. I'm just working and do what I'm supposed to do and what utilizing my experience. That's it.
Kaputov was the captain of the Renda for a mere 6 hours before it set off from Vladivostok on its journey to Korea, Japan, across the northern Pacific to Dutch Harbor, and on through almost 400 miles of ice to Nome. When asked how it feels to be a part of Nome's first winter fuel delivery, he simply shrugs.
If you consider this as a normal work, like they do, that's a regular job. Nothing extraordinary.
He says he didn't know much about Nome before the trip. His wife was able to give him a little bit of background.
My wife told me about the animated movie Balto. And then Mikhail told me that movie is about Nome.
When talking about the journey, Kaputov again seems nonplussed. Ice deliveries in Russia, he says, go on throughout the winter. They're nothing extraordinary. They're simply a way of life.
For example, every year there are goods delivered to Magadan. Over entire winter. Delivery made over entire winter.
Туда доставляется не только топливо, но и снабжение пароходами.
Not just fuel, but regular supplies.
И расстояние.
And the distance through the ice pretty much the same across the Sea of Ochotsk, entire Sea of Ochotsk, it's solid frozen.
He emphasizes the need for an experienced crew when navigating the ice. The sea, he says with a slight smile, the sea doesn't like mistakes. With few icebreakers available in the United States, Kaputov says it's almost impossible for even experienced mariners to become familiar with navigating in the ice. And that, Kaputov says, is the true lesson he learned during the course of his delivery to Nome.
One lesson I learned, and then my suggestion, the United States needs at least one real icebreaker.
The media interest generated by his journey almost puzzles him, but again he shrugs. This kind of operation, he says, just isn't news in Russia.
Yeah, it's just common in Russia, so nothing extraordinary.
After learning how to work together on the way in, Kaputov says he expects the ride out of Nome and back south to the ice edge with the Healy to be much easier. He says he wants to tell his wife a story about Nome, one that doesn't involve Balto. I'm Matthew Smith.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the statewide BP Teachers of Excellence Program. Nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com. Nominations are due by February 14th.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. AlaskaPublic.org, connecting you to Alaska, one story at a time.
Roan Boozer of Big Lake won the Kuskokwim 300 sled dog race yesterday in Bethel. The 22-year-old beat out a field of veterans, including reigning Iditarod champion John Baker of Kotzebue, who finished a half hour later in second place. KYUK's Angela Denning Barnes has more.
Roan Boozer was all smiles at the finish line. He said he knew his team could win about 100 miles into the race, where he took his mandatory six-hour break.
I had a great run and, you know, was going really fast, and I didn't even say a word. The dogs were just, you know, doing their thing, and they kept it up the whole way. So,
second-placed Baker said he made some small mistakes on the trail that added up.
Like a bum headlight, I can't see good. Bum hook, I don't know why I didn't bring my good hooks. I can't put the hook in. I mean, craziest mistakes that you would never expect. I would never expect myself to make, but the sled breaking in the middle of nowhere and just little things like that, you know.
16 teams competed. Last year's winner, Paul Gephardt of Kasilof, took third. Other finishers included four-time Iditarod champions, Lance Mackey in fifth place, and Roan's own father, Martin Boozer, in ninth. Roan wasn't running the family's A team, though. The father-son duo didn't decide which dogs each would take until the night before the race. Roan explained what he thought his advantage could have been.
I think it might be his sled might be a little less aerodynamic than mine. His sled, you can't really get as low.
Getting low was important. Mushers battled headwinds coming and going, gusts that reached 30 miles per hour and 50 below zero.
So I just kind of got really low, as low as I could on my sled, and stayed out of the wind and let my dogs kind of take care of it.
The young Boozer is no stranger to the K300. He finished fourth place when he was just 17 years old and fifth place a year later. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
The start of the Yukon Quest is less than 2 weeks out, and a key pre-race milestone, the food drop, was held Saturday. Mushers dropped off bags of food and supplies to be delivered to checkpoints along the 1,000-mile race trail. KUAC's Emily Schwing reports.
In the early afternoon, veteran Yukon Quest musher Sonny Lindner pulled his truck and trailer into a parking lot in South Fairbanks to unload his drop bags for this year's Yukon Quest International Sled Dog Race. This will be his seventh Quest run. Lindner says he hasn't packed anything out of the ordinary in his drop bags this year.
There's mostly dog food, and then a little bit of people food and booties, runner plastic.
The race starts in Fairbanks this year and travels southeast to Whitehorse, Canada. Like Lindner, Fairbanks musher and Quest rookie Paige Drobny says her drop bags are mostly filled with dog food.
Well, I guess I felt like I kind of knew what I wanted in there. I've seen a good portion of the trail, and so that makes it a little bit easier to know what to pack, but I definitely overpacked as a rookie, just not knowing how the dogs are going to be after, you know, a certain amount of miles. So I definitely packed a lot of dog food.
But for Brent Sass, there's at least one people food item he won't mush without.
Candy bacon.
You couldn't leave the candy bacon
no,
this year?
No, no. Got to have that stuff.
Anything new?
Frozen raspberries. Good stuff. I'm looking forward to eating those out there. And got a few new things for the dogs.
Josh Horst is the race manager for this year's Yukon Quest.
And it's a really fun day. Today's an exciting day for us. You know, we get to see all the mushers for the first time. It's sort of the culmination of a lot of work coming together.
Today, Horst directs more than 20 volunteers. They organize the drop bags on wooden pallets labeled with Quest Trail checkpoint names, Central, Eagle, Brayburn. Bags can't weigh more than 40 pounds. They're all clearly labeled with the musher's last name and the checkpoint where the bags will be dropped off.
It's sort of up to their strategy, right? You know, they don't want to carry more down the trail than they need, but they also want to make sure they have everything that they do need. So a lot of it just comes down to them.
Preparation is important in the Yukon Quest, but so is efficiency. Paige Drobny is confident she'll find her bags among those of all the other mushers out on the trail. A long, tentacled stencil is spray-painted in hot pink above her last name.
It's a squid. Our kennel name is Squid Acres Kennel. I did my master's degree studying squid, and it's about the only thing that I have left of that. So we put it on all the drop bags.
Food drops also happened at the same time in Whitehorse. In 2 weeks, 25 mushers will set out from Fairbanks for the 29th running of the Yukon Quest. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
One of Anchorage's best-known residents has passed away. Frank Reed, who arrived in Alaska's tent city on Ship Creek in 1915 as a toddler, died at Providence Hospital yesterday. He was 99. Reed, who would have celebrated his 100th birthday this coming December, was raised in the hotel business. His family ran the original Anchorage Hotel until the mid-1930s, and Reed often told a story about a famous guest, artist Sidney Lawrence, who paid his hotel bill with an oil painting of Mount McKinley. Speaking on KSKA's Hometown Alaska last December, Reed remembers the reactions of Alaskans the day Pearl Harbor was attacked in 1941.
Well, there was concern, naturally, and Alaskans are geographic conscious, and they easily see that our vulnerability. One sub in the Gulf of Alaska, and we'd be dead. We wouldn't have any supplies. There wasn't a road. So there was concern, and some men picked up and left the country. Some families left. But, of course, most of us stayed. But that's the way it was. And they started to get organized. They had them, shall we call them, a militia. Everybody had a gun, and most people had a gun.
Over the course of his life, Reed worked as an electrical contractor, a developer, a bank vice president, and head of the Small Business Administration in Anchorage. Reed was married for 71 years to his wife Maxine, who preceded him in death. He is survived by his daughter Pauline Reed and by numerous grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Reed's family plans to hold a celebration of his life on December 22nd of this year, the day on which Reed would have turned 100. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Stephanie Joyce and Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Matthew Smith in Nome, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation celebrates 4 decades of adding stability and security to our economy by settling Alaska families into homes across the state. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.